This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's the inner space where you, me, the top experts, and 28 Minutes collide to release a greater understanding of one of the big issues. And this week, talking of space, are we heading for space wars? Space, very much the next frontier. This summer, two senior British military commanders criticised China and Russia for their reckless behaviour in space in destroying their own satellites with weapons and leaving a dangerous trail of debris. The head of the RAF, Air Chief Marshal Sir Mike Wigston, warned that any global conflict would most likely be won or lost in space. So what might happen in a space war? And how likely is conflict up there? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. We'll begin by going way back in time to the mid-20th century and charting the growing militarisation of space. Here's the briefing room's Ben Carter.
Let me take you back more than 60 years to October 1957.
Выведя на орбиту спутник... впервые проникнуть за пределы земной атмосферы.
The USSR performed the world's first satellite launch, firing Sputnik 1 into a low Earth orbit, where it spent the next 3 weeks before its batteries ran out and it fell back into the Earth's atmosphere. It prompted the United Nations General Assembly to debate the issue of outer space the following year. Items on the agenda included...
the banning of the use of cosmic space for military purposes.
In 1959, a committee on the peaceful uses of outer space was set up and tasked with establishing principles to essentially maintain law and order in space. But within a couple of years, the Russians and Americans were both immersed in highly secret projects designed to allow them to inspect and destroy rival satellites.
One thing that happened was the Starfish Prime test in 1962, which was a high-altitude nuclear detonation conducted by the United States.
Dr. Bledin Bowen is a lecturer in international relations at the University of Leicester and an expert in space warfare and space policy.
This was part of a project designed to test missile defences and anti-satellite weapons. And this generated a massive electromagnetic pulse and it knocked out a good fraction of the active satellites and also knocked out power grids across Hawaii at the same time.
A year later, in 1963, the United States military released a film called Space and National Security, depicting space warfare.
Any nation sufficiently advanced in space technology can convert a vehicle into a military spacecraft to deny the use of space to the free world.
Such was the concern around the events of the early 1960s that in 1967, the United Nations established the Outer Space Treaty, signed by the UK, America and Russia. That went a lot further than the guidelines set up in 1959. The principles form the basis of international space law. The use of nuclear weapons in space was prohibited. But that didn't stop the United States and Russia from continuing to develop and test technology.
In the 1970s, both superpowers had continued to develop several kinds of space weapons. And among those was a test program by the Soviet Union to fire a modified MiG aircraft cannon on the Salyut space station known as Almaz. This was test-fired after removing the cosmonauts from there because the recoil would shake the space station so much it was unsafe for them. But there were many other weapon systems in development and sometimes deployed as well.
By the late 1970s, the idea of conflict in space was firmly entrenched into popular culture. George Lucas's epic space opera trilogy Star Wars captured imaginations around the world. And in 1979, James Bond battled Hugo Drax and Jaws on a space station in Moonraker. In real life, the United States and Russia were being increasingly competitive.
In the 1980s, both superpowers were building more and more satellites that were becoming more useful to military forces on Earth. And as these became so important for military power, both superpowers developed a range of additional kinds of anti-satellite technologies that would threaten these satellites. Whilst they weren't massively deployed at a large scale, both superpowers had proven technologies. A lot of these went a little bit dormant into the 1990s, but in the 2000s and 2010s, a lot of these programs have been restarted.
And other countries joined the list of nations developing space weapons. In 2007, China successfully tested an anti-satellite weapon, condemned by America and Britain. And in 2019, India shot down a satellite. And earlier this year,
China surprised many people when it launched a fractional orbital bombardment system, which is a missile that is launched into orbit, releases a vehicle that would then glide back down through the atmosphere and deliver, presumably, bombs to the targets on Earth. This is a rehashing of a lot of old Soviet and American orbital bombardment and gliding technology from the Cold War era. However, there are many questions as to how useful such a capability could be in the nuclear balance between China and the United States.
Things took a dangerous turn last month when Russia blew up one of its own satellites, creating debris that forced the crew of the International Space Station to shelter in escape pods. These recent developments have led the United Nations to question whether the laws governing space, created half a century ago, are fit for purpose today.
Ben Carter with Bledin Bowen. Now, wherever you have human activity, you need laws. So what are the rules of space today? Michelle Hanlon is Professor of Air and Space Law at the University of Mississippi in the United States. Michelle Hanlon, it's a strange first question, but what is a space lawyer?
A space lawyer is one of the most fun professions in the entire world. People like to think that space is sort of this wild frontier with no laws or anything, but the truth is that laws are about relationships between humans. So wherever humans go, laws follow. And the question is, what are those laws going to be? And that's what space lawyers are trying to figure out. What are we going to do? How are we going to relate to each other in space? Because we are truly on this threshold of becoming a multiplanetary species. And certainly in the very short term, a species that is incredibly dependent upon space activities.
How are activities in space currently governed?
Right now, we have a very sort of minimalist regime to govern space activities. It starts with the Outer Space Treaty, which was negotiated and ratified back in 1967. In the space law community, we call this treaty the Magna Carta of space law. It provides guiding principles. There's no rules like you can do this, you cannot do that. It's sort of like this is how we are going to, as humans, as states, as sovereign states, think about activities in space. And fundamental in that Magna Carta are the freedom and exploration of use of space for all, the fact that space is the province of all humankind, and that space should be used solely for peaceful purposes. I should say that the one sort of rule that is in space that we have, thankfully, is no weapons of mass destruction and no nuclear weapons may be placed in space on orbit or anywhere else. That was sort of the baseline back in 1967 during the Cold War of the most agreement we could achieve. And that's the backbone of what we are talking about with respect to space law right now.
So the no nuclear weapons in space is the one absolute law and everything else is a matter of guidance.
Exactly. And we in the space law treaty, we have something called due regard. And so instead of saying you cannot do this or you cannot do that, it says you will conduct your activities in space with due regard for the activities of others. And so I'd like to call this sort of the payday for lawyers, because as you can imagine, the concept of due regard is so gray. And lawyers can argue for decades about whether somebody was showing due regard for another.
Now, there is a UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. Does it have actual powers?
It does have actual power because the committee is made up of the international community. 104 nations are delegates to this committee. And you know what happens? Three times a year, they get together and they talk about all the stuff that's going on in space. And that's a really powerful thing to think about. These nations, even at the height of the Cold War, even when we are having issues with respect to Ukraine, with respect to China, all of these countries are in that room together talking about space activities. And so as much as we think about the militarization of space and these concerns about space weaponry, the fact is we are all talking about it. Not always friendly, often very acrimonious, but we're all at that table. And I think that's just incredibly important.
The main rules and guidance which govern space were set up a long time ago, and a vast amount has changed since then. Are those rules and guidelines really fit for purpose today?
No, they are not. You know, they provide incredible guidance. They have done a really good job of keeping peace in space. But space, as you're suggesting, has changed a lot since the 1960s. Back then, there were two superpowers. They were the only spacefaring nations. Today, we have many, many more countries launching. And even more, we have many more commercial entities not affiliated with the country launching. And so on top of that, we also have so many more uses. We have more humans going into space. We have tourism. We have people reliant on telecommunications, on GPS, on remote sensing data. And we really need to start thinking not just about militarization. We need to keep space peaceful, but we need to think about preventing conflict, preventing harmful interference. We don't want remote sensing satellites hitting each other.
What has the UN done more recently to try and get things into a more modern perspective?
The UN First Committee did something unprecedented, and they passed a resolution that said they would set up a working group to look at creating rules of conduct or a code of behavior in space. To me, this is such an incredible first step for humanity to recognize space infrastructure as something that the entire international community, not just us space nerds, really need to think about and to prevent conflict in.
If I've got my timeline right, it was after that working group was set up that Russia destroyed one of its own old satellites using a missile, I think, launched from the surface of the Earth and creating all kinds of problems. What does that make you think about the chances of the working group being successful?
I strongly condemn that test. It was unnecessary, and it created debris that put humans in space at risk. So think about being in this space station, floating around, and having to get into a lifeboat and sit in a lifeboat for several hours waiting to see if your home is going to get hit by debris. Russia is not the first country to test an ASAT in this way. China has done it. The United States has done it. India has done it. The United States and India tried very hard to reduce the debris that their ASAT tests produce. China and Russia, not so much. They created huge debris fields. There's a concept called the Kessler syndrome. There's a lot of debris in space, and the more debris we have, the more difficult it's going to be to access space, and the harder it is to keep our humans in space safe. So this Russian ASAT test should be a day of infamy. This is our wake-up call, because that test was not illegal. It was not against any law. We can argue all day long that it did not show due regard for the activities of others in space, but we don't know what due regard means. This is the wake-up call for the international community to really start getting those rules together. And maybe, just maybe, the Russians decided to do that test because that new working group hasn't met to create those rules yet, and they felt they needed to prove themselves before those rules are put in place.
I'm just wondering whether the experience doesn't suggest that getting agreement between, say, US, China and Russia on what due regard means isn't going to be really tricky.
It's going to take decades to figure that out. We have not had a binding law or treaty on space since 1972. But we have had a number of what we call soft law resolutions that are hashed out within that committee on the peaceful uses of outer space. And why is that important? Because that committee works on consensus. So everybody has to agree to every single word of those resolutions, right? And so if you are China and Russia and the United States, and you've been negotiating those resolutions for decades, you can't turn around and say, oh yeah, I didn't agree with that. So even though it's soft law, it carries with it sort of this weight. And so I don't think we're going to get next year, this is what due regard means, and oh, we're all safe and sound now. But we will get baby steps towards that goal.
Michelle Hanlon. So there are a few laws that cover human activity in space, but it's mainly about guidance. What then are the chances of conflict in space, and what form might such conflict take? Joining me in the briefing room are Alexandra Sticking, Space Strategy Lead at the consultancy Fraser Nash, and Defence Editor for The Economist, Shashank Joshi. Ali Stickings, what are the kinds of weapons that could be used, that are available to be used in space right now?
There's a whole range from the kinetic, the anti-satellite missiles that physically destroy a satellite, all the way through the non-kinetic. This is anything from GPS jabbing, dazzling the optical sensors of a satellite, so essentially blinding it for a short period of time, any sort of disruption, information disruption. And I think it really ties into the question of what we use space for. And it's about the information we're getting from space that supports those terrestrial operations. So anything you can do to prevent your adversaries from having access to that information, those are the sorts of capabilities that we might see being used.
Shashank.
In addition to all those things that Ali has mentioned, I would simply add satellites today are also computers on networks, like pretty much everything else in military life. And so you can hack into them. They can be hacked. Their ground stations can be hacked. Their information can be manipulated. Cyber war and space war are intertwined in the way that cyber is intertwined with pretty much everything these days. Space is not some sort of separate, hermetically sealed domain. It is part and parcel of the same digital networks we rely on for everything else.
So we'll be up there programming Russian satellites to think that they've been decisively defeated in Ukraine.
While they pump disinformation into ours. You know, we assume this sort of clear distinction between peacetime and wartime, and something, the balloon goes up and suddenly people unleash their weapons. All I'd say is we are seeing counter space capabilities, albeit not very visible ones, used on a daily basis now. So, for example, there's a satellite called the Sentinel-1, part of the European Space Agency's constellation. It's a radar satellite, and it's been used to pick up radar images of Russian military positions around Ukraine. Well, there are suggestions that Russia has been interfering with the radar returns of that satellite to stop it from producing those images that show just how substantial the Russian buildup is. That is a form of space war in its own way, and it's happening day to day. It just isn't as dramatic as what we think of as being a conflict in the heavens.
Essentially, Ali, there are three serious players here, aren't there? I mean, leave aside commercial players, the US, China and Russia. And I suppose the observer would say, given that they don't really get on down here, how can you make them get on up there?
That's an excellent point, because I think sometimes it's easy to see space as quite separate, and we have to understand it. It is an environment in many ways like the other domains that we have terrestrially. There is cooperation and collaboration going on. We have the International Space Station. We have a lot of scientific and exploration missions that are, you know, multilateral and have that international cooperation. But there's that tension with space being a strategic military environment and the desire to deny your adversaries access to space. It is that balance, I think, between using space for benefit whilst also recognising the role it plays in militaries and in defence.
Shashank, Ali's pointed out just how important what's happening in space is for everybody. And yet the US, China and Russia seem to be by far and away the biggest players here. Do any of the rest of us matter when it comes to deliberating what happens in space?
they matter a great deal. And that's partly because space is becoming more accessible to middle powers. You know, look at a country like Israel, which is really significant in launches of satellites and other spacecraft. Also India. Middle powers like Iran or North Korea may not have lots of satellites themselves, but they can also influence space in a military sense by lasers on the ground, by dazzling satellites, by jamming frequencies of GPS signals. And so it's not just the big powers who have a say in this. The ability to influence space, the ability to constrain other countries and how they use space is all becoming much more democratic. Countries like the United Arab Emirates have more space ambitions. And so they would like to have a say in the rules around how satellites deconflict themselves in orbit. And of course, the UK, which may not have huge space capabilities, is playing a leading role in trying to shape the rules of the road at the United Nations in getting countries to say, what do you think is a space threat? Let's have a discussion around that. So this is not just a conversation for the big powers. It's a very democratic conversation, or at least it should be.
Okay. Well, there's a difference between what is and what should be. We maybe explore a little bit more of that in a moment. But Ali, we've heard about China's hypersonic missile test in July. And one of the interesting things about that was that apparently US people looking at it thought, oh, gosh, we haven't got that technology and the Chinese have. Now, I can think of a lot of people who aren't very reassured by that piece of information. Are you one of the people who's not reassured by it?
The rate that China has been increasing its space capabilities over the last couple of decades has caused concern. But I think sometimes that there's a rhetoric around it that perhaps doesn't completely reflect reality. The US is still the most advanced and dominant, I suppose, space power. There are still areas, particularly when it comes to space capabilities, where China is still lagging behind. It's more the rate at which they have increased those capabilities, I think, that's causing the concern. And I suppose, should they overtake the US, at what stage that might happen? That's where the concern is, I think, should be focused.
Shashank, were you worried by this?
I was very worried. I think there's this assumption, and there has been, that the Chinese only copy American technology or steal it. And of course, they have done. But in many areas, missile defense, shipbuilding, so many other things, the Chinese are, according to the Pentagon's own judgment, at parity with the United States. They're not just a sort of upstart stealing and knocking stuff off. They are, you know, in some certain niche areas, peeling ahead. And I think the other important thing to remember about the Chinese in space is that perhaps 25 years ago, 20 years ago, it would have been all about blinding the Americans, stopping America from using its satellites to wage war on China, whether that's over Taiwan or something else. What we're seeing now is China build up its own constellations. So, for example, between 2020 and 2021, the Department of Defense in America estimated that the number of Chinese reconnaissance satellites had gone up by more than 80. That's a staggering increase. So China isn't just looking to space as somewhere where you stop the Americans doing nasty things to you. Space is now a domain from which they are also going to be projecting power. And of course, anytime a totalitarian dictatorship and the world's largest navy gets those capabilities, I think we all have reason for some concern.
Ali, a critical element to any governance of what happens in space is monitoring who's doing what. When you have just so many military and commercial interests going on, how do you tell whether something that's being put up in space is malign or benign?
That is perhaps the most difficult part of this, actually, when we start to determine attribution and intent. Monitoring what is happening in space is very difficult. Something called space situational awareness or space domain awareness. And that's really looking at orbit and trying to detect and track everything that's up there, that from satellites to pieces of debris. Now, this has historically been primarily a military activity. We are now seeing many more commercial operators develop this and be able to share that information. But of course, if your satellite stops working, you can't just send someone up there, you know, easily to see what happened. So first of all, you have to determine what perhaps caused a malfunction, for example. Then, you know, was anyone actually responsible? Was that intentional? It's incredibly difficult. And I think that's where it becomes particularly concerning when you think about the possibility of a miscalculation around determining intent of an attack on a satellite.
Shashank, what could you practically do to try and assist in the process of determining what is actually happening?
Well, I think, first of all, if there's ambiguity about these things, it's useful to have rules of the road. So, for example, rules around how close can one satellite approach the other so that doubt over intentions doesn't really arise. Because if a satellite gets very close, you just, you know, very rarely will you know if it's there to spy on you or in a crisis, in a moment of tension, if it's there to position itself for an attack. But I think the other thing that can also be done is a sense of building up a pattern of normal patterns of behavior, what satellites are in which orbits, normal space situational awareness, getting a sense of how are people using space on a day-to-day basis so that when you're in a crisis, you can spot deviations from that. In practice, of course, you know, I would compare this to cyberspace. You don't know if a Russian intelligence service is crawling around your systems. Are they there to spy, which is something everyone does, or are they there to potentially lay the ground to disrupt those networks in a conflict or a war? There is really no clear way of telling those things apart. And so all you can do is avoid those situations in the first place by having agreements. Agreements, for example, that say we won't hack into your nuclear command and control satellites. And in the same way, you need rules that say, well, our satellites are going to get close, but let's agree there are some satellites that are so sensitive and so important, like those that detect nuclear missile launches, that we just won't get close to those.
Given the flashpoints there are in some places in the globe which actually could lead to military action, even if it is at a relatively low level, do you think that if that happens, it will have its corollary up in space?
It would undoubtedly have its corollary in space. I think what we don't know is precisely what that looks like. And I think the consequences of a war in space are so serious, and the debris that would be generated from serious destructive acts in space would affect civilian life so greatly that I think the initial stages of warfare in space would be more limited attacks, more reversible attacks. So rather than blowing up a satellite, perhaps you jam its signals, perhaps you interfere with it, perhaps you dazzle it with lasers. You don't just blow it up straight away. So I think there would be an element of restraint in how that's prosecuted. And perhaps if that doesn't work, it would escalate on to more and more destructive things. But I think, you know, it's not clear whether the deterrence is absent or present in space. I think everyone realizes there's so much at stake. If they simply go all out at the beginning, the consequences are really terrible for everyone. So, you know, a space war at the beginning in its early stages, I think probably looks like a little bit of sparring, a little bit of sort of skirmishing, in much the same way that war on the ground does.
Alice Dickings, do you agree?
I do, absolutely. I think every time we see a kinetic anti-satellite missile test or demonstration, you have a lot of reaction that suggests that's what we're worried about. We're concerned that, you know, there's going to be this very early strike, a kinetic strike against a satellite. And I completely agree with Shashank that towards the early stages of a conflict, we're going to be seeing these non-kinetic counter-space capabilities deployed, the reversible effects, dazzling, interference, jamming, not just against the satellites themselves, perhaps against the ground stations. For me personally, yes, I see these anti-satellite tests, demonstrations, as much more of a sort of power projection, perhaps in a deterrent sense, rather than a suggestion that they are going to be used towards the beginning of a conflict.
Life doesn't get any less complicated, does it?
No, I mean, this is the story of warfare, though, isn't it? I mean, when the invention of the submarine, you know, revolutionized the way merchant shipping could be destroyed, and people thought, well, this is going to be terrible if anyone does it, completely unethical. And of course, you know, at the end, all sides eventually resorted to attacks on shipping. In cyberspace, in recent years, we have seen attacks on power grids, water facilities, all sorts of aspects of civilian life. And so warfare is always going to be rooted in something on Earth and on the ground, but it's always going to have aspects in anything that matters for warfare, and that includes cyberspace and that includes space. No domain is exempt from the effects of warfare. As long as it makes a difference to your fighting forces, as long as it helps you in some way, the other side is going to have some incentive to take it down and stop you from using it.
Shashank Joshi there with Alexandra Stickings, and my conclusion is that it's in no one's interest for there to be a space arms race. So let's not have one. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Chris Flynn and Kirstine Knight. The sound engineer was Andy Garrett and the editor is Richard Varden. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've looked into what's going on between Ukraine and Russia. We've explored the challenges the Taliban have been facing in forming a government. We've investigated the world of viral variants and how dangerous a new COVID variant might be. And we've asked why our rivers are still so polluted.
Hang on a second, just before you go, given that you've listened all the way through to this podcast, would you like to find some more great listening?
Podcast Radio Hour might be just what you need in your feed.
Cue Trail.
Podcast Radio Hour on Radio 4 Extra.
This is the podcast that recommends great podcasts, bit meta, and meets the people that make them.
So whether you're looking for comedy...
It's been painful to record because I've been laughing so hard.
Conversations...
Do you enjoy interviewing people, PJ?
It is one of my favourite activities to do.
Drama...
To me, horror is not a foreign country that you visit. It's very much the place we're inhabiting now.
Or documentaries...
What I was really interested in is not just Brittany herself, but the forces that shaped her.
We've got it all and more on BBC Radio 4 Extra's Podcast Radio Hour.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.